Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Solo. American History Month, so in this episode, we will honor the occasion by taking a deep dive into Black Chicago. Of course, this is a huge and complicated topic, but I am fortunate to have with me today a fantastic expert on Black history and culture, Mary Patillo.
Happy to be here.
Mary Patillo is the Harold Washington Professor of Sociology and Black Studies, and chair of Black Studies at Northwestern University, just outside of Chicago. She is the author of award-winning books and articles on Black urban life, politics, housing, education, and the criminal legal system. Mary was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, also known as a place of German immigration, just up Lake Michigan from Chicago, and she has lived in Chicago for over 30 years. So, Mary, when I was thinking about an introduction to this episode, I was struggling. And so I came up with three different ideas. First, I remembered that the first non-Indigenous settler in Chicago was a Black man, Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable, who opened up a permanent trading post on the mouth of the Chicago River sometime in the 1780s. So that was my first great introduction for our episode on Black Chicago. Chicago was founded by a Black man.
Definitely. That's how I always actually start my own lectures on Black Chicago.
Okay, but hold on, not so fast. Then I remembered something I learned about Native American traditions from John Lowe, the member of the Potawatomi Nation, whom we met on a previous episode on Indigenous Chicago. He reminded us that when anyone married into a Native American tribe, they became full members of the tribe. Du Sable married a Potawatomi woman by the name of Kitty Hawa. So at that point, did he become Potawatomi, or was he Black, or was he both? For Native Americans, there was no concept of dilution or partial membership in a tribe. Natives of different groups had always intermarried in order to build trading networks throughout the Great Lakes region and beyond. In fact, for about 120 years before the War of 1812, Chicago experienced a long period of peaceful coexistence between the native peoples and European traders. These traders often married into native tribes and had mixed race children, the so-called Métis, who spoke multiple languages and had one foot in their native culture and the other in European culture. And so we can imagine Du Sable's children were steeped both in the Potawatomi traditions and also Western European traditions, but also Black or Haitian traditions, as we believe Du Sable was from Haiti. So my second introduction was to paint a happy picture of Chicago as a multiracial city founded on the bedrock of peaceful and harmonious race relations.
What a nice way to think about Chicago. Quite not the history I think people first think of when they think of the city.
The long period of peaceful coexistence and mixture of cultures ended with the War of 1812, when the U.S. government moved in and effed everything up, as they always do. But returning to Du Sable, we say now that he was the first non-Indigenous settler of Chicago, but the Potawatomi claim him to be Potawatomi. Black people claim him to be Black. And the dominant historical narrative claims he was a representative of this European settler culture. He, after all, started a trading post to trade with the French and the English. and the Native Americans. So was DuSable Black Potawatomi or a culturally white settler colonialist? Don't know. One final point from Indigenous history. The concept of a tribe did not exist for Native Americans themselves. So-called tribes were given official names by the U.S. government. Because the government lawyers needed specific names for treaty negotiations with different groups of Indigenous people, so they had to be called something. But the Native Americans did not necessarily use those names themselves. These names were forced upon them. So I'm at my third attempt at an introduction.
I think you might be at your fourth.
We can't even think about Black Chicago without thinking about how hard it is to think about history and how hard it is to name things like Indigenous Chicago or White Chicago or Black Chicago. So let's start with some annoying meta questions. They're annoying, but I think they're actually very, very important and interesting. When thinking about Black Chicago, what does the term Black Chicago mean? How should we deal with these contested historical narratives? Who decides who gets to tell whose story? And how does all of this help us learn more about Black Chicago? So which of those questions or various introductions do you want to start with, Mary?
Well, I just love everything you've put on the table. It's very provocative, very appropriate for the mess that is history, really. So thank you for that. I think maybe I'll start with how do we define Black Chicago, or who gets to define Black Chicago? And I think I start all of my lectures when I'm talking to new groups about Black Chicago with DuSable, for sure. Black folks claim him, no doubt, but his identity is surely, has multiple roots. Black folks claim him because, unlike the tradition that you named for Native American folks, the tradition that has been established in the U.S. is that of the one drop rule. And the one drop rule is that one drop of black blood, which of course blood is not raced, but one black ancestor makes you black. And so given that the narrative about DuSable is that his mother was an enslaved woman in Haiti and that his father was a French European, that's one drop and that makes him black. But I also think it's very interesting that he is Haitian, because Chicago's contemporary black history, and when we think of Black Chicago today, we think it very much not beyond the U.S. borders, and we think it very much related to the U.S. South. So Black Chicago is sometimes called Mississippi North, or, something, there are so many hometown clubs from Mississippi or Tennessee in Chicago that we think about it very much in a domestic sense. But the fact that DuSable was, is the kind of person that we claim illustrates the importance of the Black diaspora, of which, of course, the U.S. is a part, but Haiti is a part and the Caribbean is a part. And of course, that's super important right now, given that the Black population in the U.S. in general, but in Chicago as well, is becoming less so, narrowly defined by Black folks who migrated north from the U.S. South, and is increasingly including Black people from Africa, from the Caribbean, even from Europe. And so I think talking about DuSable reminds us how the Black population is always changing, is always heterogeneous, is always diverse. So I think that's a good way to think about Black Chicago, as never static, never homogeneous, never able to be defined in any one way, always contended and contentious. Even when the majority of Black folks were just, were folks from Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee, the politics within Black Chicago has always been diverse and heterogeneous and contended and contentious. So I think that's a good way to think about Black Chicago, as, as a bunch of folks who, in some shape or form, define themselves by the one drop rule, as we do DuSable, but who have always been in dialogue and dissent with and from each other.
That's really interesting. So another question that I asked was basically, what does the term Black Chicago mean? So you would basically encapsulate that in, it's just basically a term that we have to use to describe just this huge different variety of different narratives and sub-communities, but we have a word that we need to use to make everything just basically easier to talk about. And sometimes language does that. It simplifies things.
Yeah.
But we kind of need these terms to say anything at all. And I'm just remembering in the first minute of my conversation about German immigration to Chicago, from a previous episode, we couldn't even establish what that meant because Germany didn't even exist. So what does it mean when we talk about German Chicago? Well, it means a lot of different things. And one great thing we're doing in this series is exploring all of those.
Yeah, I guess I'll add one more piece there, which is my own definition that I just gave, which is, you know, a bunch of folks who in some way or another appropriate or assimilate this idea of the one drop rule and thus consider themselves Black, or other people consider them Black, but within which that community is always in dialogue and dissent. So that's what I'm going to call Black Chicago. But that definition doesn't take into account geography. And geography is super important in all cities. And so Black Chicago is also a geographic moniker. It also refers to the places where those people who align themselves with the one drop rule and are in dialogue and dissent live. And the geography of it is relevant for the organizational life, for the commercial life, for the spiritual life, for the family life of Black Chicago.
We can jump ahead to another huge chapter in Chicago history, which of course is the Great Migration from the South, which you already referenced. Is there anything you want to talk about regarding Chicago history between the 1780s and like the 20th century? Are there any interesting stories you might have or interesting points, or we can get straight to contemporary issues?
Yeah, I mean, it's not my era of expertise.
Okay.
It is really important. And there's a two-volume book by Christopher Reed, who's an historian from Roosevelt University, on Black Chicago before the Great Migration. So there is a lot to be said. And this is a two-volume, this is like each volume is 800 pages. So it is not a history that where there's not much to be said.
Okay. Well, then why don't you take up the story where your expertise, you would say, begins? And what's the next important sort of historical event that allows us the opportunity to talk about some of the other issues facing Black Chicago?
Yeah, so whenever I talk about Black Chicago, I always begin with DuSable, and then I go to the Great Migration, because that's really, I mean, even the city of Chicago wasn't much before, you know, the early 1900s. So obviously there were immigrant streams in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, but the population really took off in the early 1900s. And Black folks were a part of that growth. Sometimes the Chicago Defender is given credit for the Great Migration. And there were headlines that basically invited folks north, and that was not just to Chicago, but to cities across the country. And
can you just explain these two key terms for maybe a European audience who's not familiar with the Great Migration and also the Chicago Defender?
Yes. So the Great Migration is the movement of about 7 million Black people from the south of the U.S. to the north in the period from the end of World War I to 1970. And Chicago received about 500,000 Black folks in that period. And cities across the country in the north, from New York to Cleveland to Detroit to Milwaukee to Gary, Indiana, cities large and small, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, you know, all of these cities saw their Black populations grow considerably during that period. We often think about the Great Migration as having two waves. The first wave is the end of World War I to the beginning of World War II, and that's the smaller of the Great Migration. And then the second wave begins after World War II to 1970, and that's a much bigger Great Migration. And in Chicago, these two Great Migrations have geographic manifestations. So the first Great Migration moved to the area just south of downtown and started to move south along State Street, and many of the cultural institutions on the near south side of Chicago grew up along State Street and going south in that first Great Migration. And then the second Great Migration created a West Side Black community. And so the West Side, going west from Chicago's downtown, did not have much of a Black community before the 1940s and 50s. And it was really the second Great Migration that established this Western movement and created a very large West Side Black community in the neighborhoods that are called places like North Lawndale, East and West Garfield Park, and all the way west into Austin. So that's really the West Side Black community. And then this geographic differentiation between the first and the second Great Migrations also have social class differentiations. So the first migration has been talked about more as more middle class, lower middle class. Surely both Great Migrations had large numbers of poor people moving from the South to the North. And I'll talk about why that movement in a minute. But the first Great Migration is thought about as more Black professionals and more lower middle class Black folks. And the second Great Migration was a much larger contingent of lower income Black folks. And so as a result, the internal discussions within the Black community is that the West Side Black community is poorer than the South Side Black community. And I am using very diplomatic and politic language about how Black folks talk about the West Side and the South Side, but these are real rifts. And people very much self-identify as being from the West Side or the South Side. And that says something about them.
I know Chicagoans always speak about where they come from, but I didn't quite realize in the Black community that had some other meanings.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. No, the West Side, people on the South Side look down on people on the West Side for being lower income. People on the West Side look down on the people from the South Side as being uppity, bougie, what have you. I was going to just say a little something about why the Great Migration. I mean, obviously, we're talking the early 1900s. This is the era of Jim Crow racism in the South and indeed across the whole country. Jim Crow racism manifests as separate everything, and separate everything that is not equal. So in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education struck down this idea that things could be separate and equal. But before that, the supposed law was that these things would be, that everything from schools to libraries to churches to businesses would be separate but equal, but they never were equal. You know, different parts of the bus, different parts of trains. So my parents grew up in Louisiana in the Jim Crow South. My mother, both of them were born in the 1930s. And my mother's story about separate but equal was actually, or separate but unequal, was actually not about schools, which is, of course, where most of the litigation came from, also on public conveyances and so on. But her most painful story was about the library. My mother loves to read, and she could not go to the main library. And that was devastating for her. And so libraries and water fountains, her other stories are actually about the church, about how my parents grew up Catholic, and how she had to sit either in the back of the church or up in the upper parts of the church in the back for church, for mass. This was how the urban South was. And then in the rural South, it wasn't just separate but equal, but there was terrorist violence. This is the era of lynchings, of the fact that Black people had basically no rights that were defended or respected by the law. Black people couldn't vote. Black people were relegated to the worst jobs. Black people could not defend themselves. And that kind of racism, of course, was a push factor for Black Southerners looking for freedom. And the North was supposedly the promised land. Of course, Black folks got to places like Chicago and realized it was not the promised land, but it nonetheless looked like the promised land compared to the South. And in the North, Black folks could vote and did vote. And in the North, Black folks did go to schools with white folks. And in the North, Black folks could get decent housing and could get more decent jobs. And so that was the pull of the North during the Great Migration.
So, Mary, you mentioned some push and pull factors. The racism in the South was a push factor, and potential better opportunities economically in the North was a pull factor. But you also mentioned the Chicago Defender as being a very important part of the pull factor.
Yeah. The Chicago Defender is Chicago's Black newspaper, and it was founded in 1905. I mean, the story of the Chicago Defender is just so important. You know, many people have called rap music, for example, today, the CNN of Black America. Well, of course, this was the precursor to the CNN of Black America. And you will see, for example, pictures of people in the South who have wallpapered their walls with the Chicago Defender. Now, many folks in the South weren't even literate during these years, you know, the early 1900s. But you can see other pictures of people crowded around an individual reading the Chicago Defender to a group of other Black folks who could not read. So the Chicago Defender and other Black newspapers, but Chicago Defender is one of the anchors, along with the Pittsburgh Courier, the New York Amsterdam News, the Baltimore Afro-American. These papers were integral to the circulation of information in Black communities across the country. So, of course, before Black Twitter, this was how Black folks learned about what's going on in Black politics across the country. And so the Defender is often credited with motivating the Great Migration through calls to Black folks in the South to come to the North. I think it's really interesting. As an urban sociologist, we there's this theory in urban sociology called the growth machine, which is that there is a basically kind of conglomerate of interests that always wants city populations to grow. And this includes city government, of course, but also private corporations and businesses, that growth is always good for the city powers. And in that regard, the Defender was part of this growth machine, because, of course, the bigger the city of Chicago, the greater the Defender's circulation and the more money it could make as well. And I'm not saying the Defender was totally motivated by, you know, capitalist interests to grow its readership, but it did benefit in that way. And it also had motivations it was a race paper. That's what it would have been called at the time. A race man and a race woman were people who were for the betterment of the Black community. And the Chicago Defender was a race paper interested in the betterment of the Black community. And this move north was part of that socioeconomic and political betterment.
I have just a technical question. Mm-hmm. So the Black Defender, I'm sorry. What was the name?
The Chicago Defender.
The Chicago Defender would be what, loaded on trains daily and taken down throughout the South, or how are they distributing this to the
So
places
the
far away?
Well, one of the biggest lures is that Pullman porters. So the Pullman rail car was you know, this was the era of rail travel, and the Pullman car was the most fancy of the rail cars. And the Pullman rail cars would be attended to by Pullman porters. And these Pullman porters, many of whom were Black, were one of the main ways of the circulation of the Chicago Defender. So they would be on these trains from the most important one is the one from New Orleans to Chicago, which actually still runs on the Amtrak line. This train from New Orleans to Chicago, these Pullman porters would be on this line, and they would get the Chicago Defender in Chicago and bring it to all points on the stops in the South. So Memphis and through Mississippi and all the way down to New Orleans. And they were these informal distributors of the Chicago Defender.
That's fascinating. And I'd not known that, but I've been learning so much in this series. One of the things I learned about technology is that there was a big German language newspaper scene in Chicago. The most famous was the Stadtzeitung. Mm-hmm. And the telegraph had just been laid across the Atlantic. They were so big and had enough money to have reporters on the ground in Germany, as it were, in Europe.
And wow.
Chicago Germans would get news about what was going on in Germany before Germans themselves would know. And we're talking around 1900, because there was censorship going on there. But these reporters would send their telegraph articles so the Germans in Chicago would know what was going on. This is 125 years ago, before Germans in Germany themselves.
Wow.
And this story about these creative ways of distributing the Chicago newspaper around the South, I think, is also just a wonderful example of using now train technology to distribute knowledge.
And I think this example that you're giving about the German, transatlantic German community, it has its counterpart in the Black community as well. So I actually had an undergraduate student do her senior thesis on coverage of the occupation of Haiti by the U.S. government in the 1930s in Black newspapers. And there was a lot of coverage of this occupation. And so similar to what you're talking about this transatlantic German news source, these Black neighborhoods were also relevant for Black diasporic news and politics about Black folks outside of the U.S. And whether it was elite Black folks who were traveling to Haiti or actual, you know, later, you know, there are also, you know, things, for example, during the divestment movement in South Africa and before that, whether it's actual journalists being on the ground in South Africa or in West Africa for various political moments. You know, this was Black journalism is really awesome. I it's amazing now that we're in this moment of information so easily and readily available to think about the work that went into getting information across the seas in the early 1900s. But the Black newspapers were doing it in so many creative ways.
As we continue our story, so we've talked about the two waves of the Great Migration. Where would you like to now take us on our little train journey?
There are so many places to go.
This is something that I was thinking about as I was thinking about topics for the program today. And one thing I always think about is Chicago is known also for being like a divided city and at times a racist city. And then we get sort of overwhelmed with negative stories about Chicago in general and violence in Chicago and Black Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it seems like certainly when you read about news from Chicago in Europe, no one ever talks about how awesome Chicago is and how awesome Black Chicago is.
Yes.
And so, I mean, maybe we can focus on one or the other, but what do you think about this perception problem?
I would
say, like, we can hold two ideas in our head at the same time, but it seems like there's a lot of negativity in public perception about Black Chicago. So how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I would respond to that by actually giving a little bit of history again, which is to refer to St. Clair Drake and Horace Caton's book, Black Metropolis. So St. Clair Drake and Horace Caton were social scientists at the University of Chicago in the 1930s who undertook a massive social scientific study of Black Chicago at the time. The book is nearly 900 pages, and then there were updates in the 1960s, and it's just an incredible piece of social science. And one of their main theses is that we can think about Black Chicago in two ways, the Black ghetto and Black metropolis. The Black ghetto is the place that is the consequence of segregation and separation, of racial discrimination, of relegation to poor jobs and poor housing conditions. It's the place where tuberculosis is disproportionately prevalent. It's the place where there are rats and dilapidated buildings. It's the place of basically disease and despair. That's the Black ghetto that, again, is the consequence of disinvestment or never investment in the first place, or political marginalization and what have you. But the book is called Black Metropolis. And so this place, Black Metropolis, also called the South Side or Bronzeville, which is a word we still use today, that's the place that most outsiders never see or never talk about. Black Metropolis is the place where there are hundreds of churches and hundreds of businesses and parades and nightclubs and the blues and jazz and just active and robust political debate and discussion and Black libraries and Black entrepreneurs and Black writers and Black artists, you know? So you get my drift here, which is that part of Black Chicago has always existed and continues to exist. Black metropolis, you know, basically what Black folks spend our days doing. Yes, we know that there is crime and we take precautions to keep ourselves safe. But most of the time we are going to school, we are going to work, we are creating, we are playing, we are loving, we are, you know, doing all the things that folks do in community, which is still a part of Black Chicago. So the organizational infrastructure of Black Chicago. I live right next door to a place called Little Black Pearl, which is an organization begun by an artist named Monica Hayslip. Her theme is art and the business of art. And obviously the title Little Black Pearl shows that she's focused on Black youth. I live in the Black community on Chicago South Side. And she has developed artists and a school for an alternative school for older young people who don't go to regular Chicago public schools. And has just, there's a coffee shop in there and the young people from the school work in the coffee shop. And it's just a glorious place to go. It is absolutely beautiful, filled with Black faces and Black sculpture and motivating stories. The coffee shop is called Carver 47, named after George Washington Carver, who was an inventor and did all kinds of wonderful things with the peanut. And so Little Black Pearl is just one of so many examples of Black institutions on the South and West sides that really, you know, show the lie to the other version that people see on the outside, which is only death and despair. That is not all of what Black Chicago is.
How do you explain the persistence then of this perception gap?
Oh, that's easy. If it bleeds, it leads.
Is it just the R word? All right.
Yeah, no, it's news. It is racism, of course, as well. Mm-hmm. But if it bleeds, it leads. And so the news media, again, I don't want to minimize the fact that there is violence in Black Chicago and that people's lives are devastated by it. Young people are killed. Older people are killed. People feel unsafe. It tamps down the life that Black Chicago could have by taking life, but also by instilling fear. That is true. Mm-hmm. The fact that Black Chicago continues to create and love and play despite that is a testament to the resilience of Black Chicago. And I think the external representations of Black Chicago are driven by news media for which this is a moneymaker, driven by politicians. Obviously, Trump has taken to critiquing Chicago, and mostly that's Black Chicago, as part of his political efforts to malign lefty liberals who supposedly let criminals out of jail and then run amok in places like Chicago or, you know, wherever else he is talking about for the week. But I agree also that also has very racist undertones and overtones. Mm-hmm. And is only one side of the story.
You mentioned politics, so why don't we talk a little bit about Black politics and Black leadership in the Black mm-hmm. metropolis?
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting that, you know, that the only story, one of the stories that people hear on the outside of Chicago is about crime. But, you know, Chicago has an incredible rich tradition of Black politics. So I don't know where one might start, but you know, I do want to make sure I bring up one name
yeah.
because it's somewhat related to politics in Chicago, even though she was never an elected official, and that's Ida B. Wells. And so I want to, you know, mention Ida B. Wells because she also is emblematic of this deep history of Chicago. Ida B. Wells was a journalist before coming to Chicago in Memphis. She wrote about the terror in her hometown. She wrote about this in her newspaper, and as a result was basically driven out of town by white vigilantes who wanted to quiet her and to basically send a message to Black middle-class folks and Black entrepreneurs in Memphis that their upward mobility was dangerous for them. So she left Memphis, she came to Chicago, and Ida B. Wells became a tireless crusader against lynching in the South and against all manner of anti-Black violence. So, as I mentioned, she never was an elected official in Chicago, but she anchored a Black political community in Chicago that was relevant both for the politics of Chicago, but also for national politics, because Ida B. Wells was a voice pushing anti-lynching legislation in Washington, D.C., arguing for the representation, the positive representation of Black folks. And so she is a voice for Black progress in many ways. And so in that regard, she anchors where I want to start thinking about Black politics in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Because
also
of
a woman.
Course, And a woman, definitely.
A woman journalist, a woman professional.
A woman journalist, yep. And has been embraced now. So we just, here in Chicago, we just renamed Congress Parkway, Ida B. Wells Parkway. Indeed, many things are changing in Chicago. The Lakeshore Drive is now Jean-Point Baptiste du Sable Lakeshore Drive. It's a very long name.
It is.
I don't know if people will actually use it. It does come up on Google Maps, so that's a good thing, but it's very long. So yeah, I think Chicago is really in this moment of relearning its history, and I think that's a good thing. Okay, so back to Black politics. You know, I just will call out some names. Harold Washington, Chicago's first elected Black mayor, had also served as a congressman from Chicago. And then he very much moved away from the politics that had excluded Black folks or had kind of contained Black folks into a voting bloc that could be marshaled for the purposes of white machine politics. So, you know, Chicago machine politics, what is the Democratic machine? The machine is this system of politics and labor patronage whereby politicians galvanized the vote by offering goodies to people who voted for that machine politician. And this is a decades old tradition in Chicago, and it's not dead, even though
we've talked about it in with respect to German immigrants, of course, from the 1830s through the 1880s.
Yeah. And of course, you will, if you're going to do an episode on the Irish in Chicago, that, of course, is super important to the Irish in Chicago, with the dailies being Chicago's anchor to the Irish community in politics. So Chicago's Black community was a part of this machine as well. And Black politicians, whether it be congresspeople like Big Bill Dawson or alder people, what we now call alders, but in that day and age were called aldermen, would deliver the Black vote to white politicians. And in many regards, Harold Washington interrupted that. And he brought together what we often call the Rainbow Coalition, the coalition of North Side liberals or white liberals on the North Side and Chicago's Black community and Chicago's Latino community, to kind of bring together what we might consider as something more politically agentic as opposed to politically instrumental. The machine is politically instrumental. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. Politically agentic is, how do we all move forward together? What's in our interest and how do we push that forward politically? And so I think in many regards, Harold Washington was this moment to think about what the Black community needed to improve. Now, of course, he took office at a time when Chicago's Black population, when Chicago's population overall, so Harold Washington took office in 1983, and Chicago's population has been on the decline since the 1980s. And Chicago's Black population has been on a very precipitous decline since the 1980s. And that population decline has led to large tracts of vacant land, private disinvestment, shrinking tax base, emptied schools. And so it's been difficult to govern since the 1980s. A shrinking city. Mm-hmm. There have been moments of renaissance and there are parts of Chicago that are booming, but Chicago's Black community has been on a long-term decline in population that has made it difficult to kind of shore up the positive organizational infrastructure in Black communities. So I'll stop there and then I'll kind of see where you want to go.
Yeah, no, this is great. Well, I have two more politicians that I think we could discuss.
Okay.
The previous mayor, who is a Black lesbian, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then someone that I don't think anyone around the world will be familiar with, Barack Obama, who when you were describing Harold Washington's approach to politics, I was like, dang, is that approach what Obama learned when he was a political or community activist in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you discuss either or both President Obama and the previous mayor, whose name I forgot.
Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot, yes. Well, I'll start with Obama because I'm currently in a love-hate relationship with Obama. You know, you gotta love Obama because he made Chicago his home. He represents Chicago. He has been proud of the political education he received in Chicago and in Illinois. And as a result, Chicago has embraced him. I live four blocks from the house that he lived in here in Chicago that he still owns. I know him from the neighborhood. And so in that regard, you know, I know him to be a decent and brilliant person. But what's going on currently is Obama is building his presidential center. And he's building it in Jackson Park, which is a park on the south side, probably about 2 miles from his home. It's southeast of Hyde Park, which is the neighborhood where the University of Chicago is, which is where Obama was a law professor for a number of years. And so, you know, he has lots of connections to this part of Chicago. And so my bone that I'm picking with Obama is that he's building this presidential center in Jackson Park, in the park, on parkland, in an area that was an asset, has been an asset for the South Side of Chicago. And while there are dozens of vacant tracts of land on the South Side of Chicago where this presidential center could have been built and could have added an asset to the South Side, Obama and the developers and the foundation and so on and so forth chose to put it on park land where there were already many assets, both natural and physical assets. There was a track there, which they have moved to another location. And no doubt the presidential center is going to be an asset. And so we welcome it on the South Side. But I have made my own sentiments public that I think it should have gone in an area or on some land that needed improvement as opposed to land that was already improved. So that's my bone to pick with Obama.
I was expecting something a lot more challenging than that. That seems like a reasonable complaint. Well, we have 3.5 black mayors. Mayor Sawyer replaced Harold Washington, who passed away in office. But the current mayor and the previous mayor are also black. So let's talk about Lori Lightfoot and the new mayor. And what does it say that you know, black people are now seem to be having much more political influence in the city?
Yeah. So it's fascinating, interestingly, that Chicago is electing black mayors at a time when the black population is declining, at a time when the white population has surpassed the black population. So let me just give a little demographics. Chicago has for a long time been roughly a third black, white, Latino. Which third was actually slightly larger has changed over time. So black people were the plurality in the 1980s and 1990s, but contemporarily white people are the plurality, and their population, their numbers are actually growing, whereas the black population is declining, and the Latino population is also growing. And indeed, now white people are the largest population, followed by Latinos, followed by black people. So that is, you know, a big change. And it's interesting that it's at this moment that we are electing black mayors when the black population is declining. Now, obviously, I think that's because politics isn't just about race. Politics is obviously about political beliefs, but politics is also about the ability to bring together a coalition. And our current mayor, for example, Brandon Johnson, was very heavily involved in the education community. And I think it's there where he was able to make some alliances across the Latino and white communities. Mayor Lightfoot, I will just speak honestly as a black Chicagoan, I just didn't understand. So I say this because she does not have strong roots in Chicago's black political history. Brandon Johnson has much more. Harold Washington, for example, was deeply steeped in Chicago's South Side black community. Mayor Lightfoot, you know, we started this podcast, I talked about Black Chicago as a label for black people in Chicago, but also a label for a geographic region. Mayor Lightfoot lives on the North Side, which is not a part of Black Chicago in any sense, has never been thought of as a part of Black Chicago. Clearly, there are black people who live on the North Side, and there are even pockets in some parts of the North Side that have a sizable black community. For example, in the Rogers Park neighborhood on the far North Side, there's a significant black Caribbean community. In the Uptown neighborhood, there's a significant black African community, but she lives in none of those parts and lives, I think she lives in Logan Square. I'm not quite sure what neighborhood she lives in, but it's not a majority black neighborhood. So I was surprised by her victory. She beat Tony Preckwinkle, who is still the Cook County Board President. The city of Chicago is within the administrative region of Cook County, and Tony Preckwinkle is the elected official that runs Cook County. Tony Preckwinkle is also a black woman and who has much deeper ties to the black community, not as deep as say Harold Washington did. Both of them, actually, Harold Washington and Tony Preckwinkle, were very much connected to Hyde Park, which is the neighborhood where the University of Chicago is, which is much more integrated, one of the few integrated neighborhoods in Chicago, actually, but still has a sizable black population, and it's nestled within the larger black South Side. And Tony Preckwinkle had been an alder person in the Fourth Ward, which includes many predominantly black neighborhoods, including parts of Hyde Park. So Lori Lightfoot beat Tony Preckwinkle, which I was extremely surprised by, because she won most of the South Side precincts, despite not being, and West Side precincts, despite not being steeped in Black Chicago. And maybe my surprise is vindicated by the fact that she only won one term. And maybe she was an unknown and people wanted a change. Tony Preckwinkle is very much tied to the Democratic leadership in Chicago and the machine as it is in this contemporary moment. And so perhaps people wanted something new, and Lightfoot came into office, 4 years of information, and people decided to go in a different direction.
Yeah, it's interesting that she only lasted one term. From what mm-hmm. I remember, she just basically made a lot of enemies but didn't make any friends.
Exactly.
But the other story I know from Chicago is that governing Chicago is a very, very difficult job. It's not, it's not one of the easier mayorships in the world.
I assume.
Okay, so we're reaching the end of our discussion today. We started with, and I think maybe I should redo the introduction. It's way easier just to say that Chicago was founded by a Black person. We don't necessarily need all of this complexity, but actually.
I loved your introduction.
That's very kind.
Why would you want to change it? I think especially given that your podcast, you know, treats so many of the different communities that have come to call Chicago home, it's a perfect encapsulation of that.
Thank you. I promise I will keep it. But
okay.
But I think the other thing, and I'll allow you to conclude in a second, one of the most important things I learned from focusing on Black Chicago today is that all of these different communities have so much in common, that the German immigrant community has a lot in common with the Southern Black community that came to the North. The way they organized themselves politically has similarities. The way they communicated back to their homelands, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call them. And it just reminds me that, well, Chicago is a really diverse place, and there is lots of conflict in Chicago, and there is violence and all this, but actually the different groups have much more in common than we actually realize.
Yeah, and I actually think it's difficult to make that observation because so many of us are steeped in the scholarship of the community that we study. And so I think you doing this podcast allows you to take a master class in Chicago by listening to those of us with expertise. But you get to hear the full sweep. So I look forward, actually, because I do consider myself obviously a student of Black Chicago, but also a student of Chicago. So I look forward to taking your masterclass in Chicago once all the podcasts are released.
Well, let me end then with a lesson I learned from the Potawatomi Nation.
Mm-hmm.
When I gave the introduction to the episode about indigenous Chicago, I made the mistake of saying that the Native Americans arrived 12,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age. And I was mm-hmm. corrected by lovely John Lowe, who said, in our tradition, we were always here.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, but we also believe in our tradition that there is truth to all of these different narratives and truth to all of these different stories. And we don't necessarily have to set them against each other. It would be way better if we could allow them to exist side by side without too much critique. So that's the lesson I've drawn from the Potawatomis, and you've reinforced that today about Black Chicago.
And can I actually end, and you can decide how you want to use it, because I think it's relevant for what you just said, which is that Black artists have also obviously not said that Black folks have been in Chicago for always, but you know, we have blended with the land. We have blended with the place. And so I'm just going to read a stanza from Gwendolyn Brooks, who is Chicago's famed Black poet. And this is from a poem called Primer for Blacks. And she writes, quote, "Blackness stretches over the land. Blackness, the black of it, the rust red of it, the milk and cream of it, the tan and yellow tan of it, the deep brown, middle brown, high brown of it, the olive and ochre of it. Blackness marches on." I just love that poem for bringing in all of the shades of blackness, bringing in this connection to the land, bringing in this presence that Black Chicago still has.
Those are really fine words to end. And you didn't know this, but I'll tell you now, we will be discussing Gwendolyn Brooks, the fine Chicago poet, in April for National Poetry Month.
What a perfect segue.
You hit it out of the park, Mary. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The AmericaCentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaCentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.